Welcome to your new life and our new times, in what has been labeled as humanity's greatest leap in evolution. Dr. K is here to assist you with holistic tips and tools, clearings and activations for your vibrational upgrade. Dr. Allison J. K. has been working as an energy medicine practitioner for 20 years, having lived in Asia for 10 years to study subtle energy. People refer to Dr. K as the lightning bolt due to the high voltage of the work she does on behalf of assisting you to thrive in mind, body, and spirit. That is the greatest backdrop to life on planet Earth right now.
We have a special treat today. You can hear it. I'm so excited. We have Dr. William Tiller of the William Tiller Foundation, and he's given me permission to go ahead and call him Bill. Hi, Bill. Welcome.
I'm pleased to be here, Allison. Good to talk to you. Happy afternoon.
Where are you right now? You're in California, right?
No, I'm in Scottsdale, Arizona.
You're in Arizona. You're close to the Voice America radio network. They're in
Yes, we have been here for, we've been in this part of Arizona for 14 years.
That's a special part of our country. There's a lot of activity there. Bill,
yeah, after I retired from Stanford, we moved to northern Arizona. I have a laboratory up in Payson, about 80 miles north of here.
That's where it is. Okay. So, yeah, let me just give a brief introduction to Dr. William Tiller. He left, as he just referred, he left Stanford as a scientist. He was actually a department chair of the university's Department of Material Science, where he spent 34 years in academia, and he was 9 years the advisory physicist with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories, and he has a host of published papers in conventional scientific journals. He has over 30 years of experience, and he has been one of the leading advocates, and this is why he flagged my attention, in applying science to consciousness and to the studies of consciousness and kind of taking what quantum physics discovered way back in the beginning of the 1900s and actually working with it instead of avoiding it as much of orthodox science has done since the discovery. And it's only in the last 10 or 20 years or so, and William Tiller has been a leading pioneer in this, where there are new sciences. Scientists like Bruce Lipton as well have stepped out of the orthodox science so that they can have more freedom to explore what is really impacting us in our lives. And so he has applied the traditional scientific training to the study of consciousness and has given us so much information about how consciousness works. And that's what we're going to talk about today. He works with something called psychoenergetics. So, Bill, would you like to describe psychoenergetics?
Well, psychoenergetics is a term that came from Russia originally. The psyche, of course, that's the psycho part of it, and energy is pretty obvious as well. They chose this term, psychoenergetics, in order to study various aspects of consciousness and aspects of parapsychology, so that their masters would allow them to do that by using that term. They saw it as a useful thing in the communist world. So that's where it came from. And in essence, the orthodox science community, since the days of Descartes, which was the early 1600s, mm-hmm. it was that no... Well, the assumption that Descartes made, which was very useful in that day, was that no human qualities of consciousness, intention, emotion, mind, or spirit can significantly influence a well-designed target experiment in physical reality. And that has been the dictum since over the last 400 years, and although it isn't talked about by the orthodox science community, it's deeply wedded in their information structure. So even though a great deal of work has been done in this area for the last 150 years, because it is not internally self-consistent with the frame of reference of Orthodox science, which is distance time, they chose not to realize it was an important part of nature, and therefore they should begin to seriously look at it, because it didn't fit their worldview. They decided it was more comforting just to sweep it under the rug. And we're still at that stage. Orthodox science deals with a reference frame of nature, which is distance, time only. And so much of the qualities of humans, the aspect of consciousness, the aspects of healing, you find that these phenomena are not distance-dependent and not time-dependent in the same way we normally think of that in the Orthodox science community. So I have sort of on the side as an avocational pursuit, I have been studying psychoenergetic science and continue, of course, to do my Orthodox science with my PhD students at Stanford every day until I started with my mother back in 1970. So I've been doing it for a long time. Mm-hmm. And developing a new model of nature for humans.
Yes. Yes.
And ways to understand these things, which ultimately I think will be the science of this century.
Yes.
But Orthodox science isn't ready to look serious at this yet. But they will as time goes on.
And you've had, I mean, there's videos on your website. His website, y'all, is www.tiller, T-I-L-L-E-R.org.
Yes.
It's on the web page here that you're listening to the show from. If you look down to the bottom right, you can see access Dr. William Tiller's website here. On the website, you have videos, Bill, that there's actually, I remember seeing one, and I don't know if it's currently on the website, but it might be in your YouTube videos. You have somebody interviewing you about the backlash you received from Orthodox science, and you talk about the internal self-consistency. And this is primary to my book. The entire discussion behind what if there is nothing wrong is focused on why we have the beliefs that we have as average Americans, how we get it from science, and how science has been unable to deal with the lack of time and space when we're looking at a whole realm of nature, which is what you just said. A whole realm of human life is about energy and consciousness, and it is not dependent on time or space. And because that's not internally self-consistent with the Orthodox scientists, with how they construe and what they then therefore study and what they then therefore tell us is our truth and reality, and we then therefore operate from, because it's so difficult to accept, they haven't.
And remember, let's go back to the days of Copernicus and Galileo and Kepler and Newton. Basically, the theocrats, who were the priests of the day, they said that the sun rotates around the earth and everything, all the planets rotate around the earth. But of course, Galileo did lots of experiments, as did Kepler, with their telescopes, and the data showed that that was not so. It was the other way around. And that basically the priests of the day, just like the scientists of today, their belief system was otherwise. It was, in fact, that everything rotated around the earth, and they weren't even willing to look through the telescope at the data. They just knew what the right answer was. Well, that's not a very good way of going. So the issue of science, I mean, logos, in the old days there was logos and mythos, and they were complementary views of nature. One looking out at nature, that was the logos. One looking inward was mythos. And so the logos transformed into what we call science. It took more than 100 years for the theocrats to really change their viewpoint, in spite of the fact that there was abundant experimental data to show that they were wrong. The same issue exists today. There's abundant experimental data to show that the scientists of today and medicine, exactly, because it just follows orthodox science.
Correct.
So there
yep.
is so much available in the universe that is not acceptable to them. They have phenomena that they can't understand, or at least they say they don't understand, but the data is there. It's pretty obvious, pretty straightforward, if they are willing to open their eyes a little further. So, I'm a card-carrying orthodox scientist as well, but I have opened my eyes and my mind.
Bill, what is it? What is it about these particular discoveries about time and space? One of the things that you say that I quote in my book is about how there are not, as of yet, technologies to access consciousness, that instead it has to be done experientially, that there it goes beyond a realm of measurement. And this is very much where I'm going in my book, that we're using old tools and systems designed to measure something much more tangible based on Newtonian physics, and that we're not really equipped with the tools. And you're one of the leading pioneers to develop the tools to be able to measure these things and prove them.
That's the key issue. And I think pretty much all of the listeners will know about the big flap of the Higgs boson in about June of this year. Scientists were very, very pleased to say that they've finally discovered it in CERN, near Geneva, by having photons run a track and collide with other protons going the other way, and they have found evidential data that is satisfying to them that they've discovered the Higgs boson. The Higgs boson was theoretically predicted by Peter Higgs in 1964, and they've been looking for it ever since because the Higgs boson is an active agent which endows mass to the various particles, the leptons, the quarks, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a big deal, and it sort of is a completion of the standard model, which supports the Big Bang theory, which I think is also in error, only in the sense that they think that the Big Bang sort of grew spontaneously out of the vacuum, which supposedly contains nothing, mainly because things appear to be transparent. The vacuum appears to be transparent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that I look at the Higgs boson as a kind of completion, not opening necessarily new doors in the universe. And when I say completion, it's the completion of the standard model, and the standard model is that everything goes slower than the velocity of light. And the basis of most of our tools for studying things is electromagnetic energy, and its limitation is the velocity of electromagnetic light through vacuum, through physical vacuum. So now, if that indeed is closure, it's the closure of the slower-than-light domain of nature.
Mm.
And all the rest of it is the faster than light. And that's where healing energies mainly function, all kinds of things mainly function, consciousness, etc. But we don't have tools. The Orthodox science community is now run out of tools to go into this higher domain. With our psychoenergetic work, we're developing some of these tools, and we're seeing other aspects of nature that are quite different and very foreign to the Orthodox science community. So it's, in a way, it is a beginning from a scientific perspective, not that they see it that way, but
right.
It is going to be a beginning of moving into new territory, which is faster than the velocity of light, and all the aspects of the physical vacuum appear to be faster than light. For example, people think that the physical vacuum, that there's nothing there. And you might think that because electromagnetic energy doesn't seem to be interacting with anything in this transparent medium. And in fact, with electromagnetic energy going through the vacuum, you can change the frequency, whatever electromagnetic frequency you want, they all move at the same velocity, this particular velocity of light, which again would indicate that it's not interacting with anything that's there if something is there. And yet, John Wheeler, a rather remarkable physicist who was an astrophysicist, and he calculated that in order for quantum mechanics and relativity theory to be internally self-consistent, then the physical vacuum had to contain a latent energy potential of 10 to the power 94 grams equivalent per cc of physical vacuum. Well, if you go through the numbers and you just look at our cosmos, that is a sphere of radius 15 billion light years, and multiply that by the average mass density which of the cosmos, which the astronomers can give you, you get a number, a very, very big number. And on the other hand, if you take just a single hydrogen atom, which is almost all empty space, there's a proton with an electron going around it. If you take that vacuum, it's nearly all empty space, and you multiply that vacuum, which is sort of 1 over a 1 followed by 22 zeros, all right? Very, very small volume. But you multiply it by 10 to the 94, then what you find is that that latent energy, just in that small space, is a trillion times that of all the latent energy in all the electromagnetic mass, in all the planets, and all of the stars, and all of the cosmic dust in a sphere of radius 15 billion light years. So what we are seeing, and when you look at that sum, that this is amazing, the potential of the physical vacuum. The second thing that we're seeing is, when you ask the question, why does the vacuum in outer space and the vacuum that is really between the fundamental particles that make up the atoms and molecules of our normal electromagnetic world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what I'm calling the physical vacuum. How come there's supposed to be so much there? And if it is there, indeed, and the light goes through it and doesn't appear to interact with it, how can that happen? Well, the only conclusion you can come to is that if you have slower-than-light waves of stuff interacting with faster-than-light waves of stuff, then, of course, one will not interact with the other because the light barrier, in the conventional theory, nothing can go faster than light. But if something is there faster than light, and of course that something can still satisfy relativity theory, then they will repel each other. They won't positively interact with each other.
Right.
So that plus other theoretical work from de Broglie and such with particle pilot waves, that indicates when you go through the mathematics of that, you find that there are three velocities that are important. One is the particle velocity, which is less than the velocity of light. The second is the group wave, and that goes at the same velocity as the particle. So that's, again, slower than the velocity of light. But then there's also the pilot wave, whose velocity is given by c squared divided by the velocity of the particle. Since that velocity of the particle is always less than that of light, then
yes,
the pilot wave of de Broglie is always faster than the velocity of light.
And C is energy in the equation equals
C
mc
is,
squared.
C is the velocity of the electromagnetic waves and electromagnetic particles. It's 3 times 10 to the power 10 centimeters per second. Very fast.
So the bottom line, what you're saying is that recently there's been a discovery that has validated a separation and has completed a sense of understanding of why it's been such a disruptive discovery that it seems like quantum physics unearthed back in 1905 in trying to understand how can there be this kind of both behavior at the subatomic level of both particles and waves. How can a particle that's supposed to just be a particle, meaning something that's going to break down and become physical, how can it also have properties of light and be a wave at the same time? And this,
well, it's a little more complex than that.
Yeah, I'm trying to break it down for the average listener, will you?
Well, the issue is that the boson, it basically provides closure in my sense. The orthodox community says it gives a kind of closure. It now explains where mass comes from. But I don't think that they see it as closure. They see it as opening a new door. But that door is probably the physical vacuum. And the physical vacuum appears to be full of stuff that is all traveling faster than the velocity of light. And orthodox science has no tools to measure things that go faster than light because the building blocks of their general tools are electromagnetic energy, which does not appear to go faster than the velocity of light, but the velocity of electromagnetic light. There are many other kinds of light in my modeling. Mm-hmm. Healing energies are basically aspects of light, but other kinds of light than is imagined in the orthodox by the orthodox science community. And the data that you get from parapsychological studies of Bob John and Brenda Dunn and others at Princeton, the Pearl Laboratory, they show that there appears to be no distance dependence of these particles or waves that they see in the parapsychological responses to things. And likewise, the time dependence is not like what we see in our orthodox science community. So there is this conflict, and there always has been this conflict. And since the power structure has been the orthodox science community, they've just, as I said, they swept all that information under the rug. When it gets out, you can't really, the journals will not publish that kind of material, etc. And so they're, as I say, they're acting today very much like the theocrats acted in the days of Galileo. So it's an interesting time.
Indeed, it's an interesting time, because then that translates into us not having an awareness, the average citizen, unless they do a lot of asking of questions and listening and searching, we don't have a model in our country that supports validating the existence of all the other aspects of life that can't be measured by science, because they stay out of the journals. They're not validated by our science. And our tradition in our country is, and in the West, is to rely on science to translate what reality is to us. So if we have a science that's denying the existence of all of these other energies that are faster than the speed of light simply because they don't have tools to measure them and they can't make them be self-consistent with what they have as their view of reality, then we're not, as an average citizen, given that view. And so we believe that...
That's correct. And the issue is with the general public, they like the idea of faster than light and other phenomena because it gives them hope that, indeed, there is impact from emotions, mind, and spirit. It gives them hope that the world is truly, it's not as materialistic as the orthodox science community would have us believe. And so that's a good change, as far as I can see.
Yeah. So what's one of the more interesting, so when you talk about parapsychology, that tends to be sometimes laughed at and guffawed at. I mean, even
well, that's the way in which you put things down, you see. That's exactly what the theocrats did to Galileo.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the people that are in power, whether it's the scientists of today or the theocrats of that day, they can't, because they feel they're superior and they have superior knowledge, they can't help but using hubris. And you ridicule people who think otherwise. And that happens today just as it happened in the old days, but it turns out they were wrong. And it was very difficult for the theocrats to change their worldview, to realize that they have to gather experimental data rather than theological data.
Oh, they didn't even believe. I mean, Copernicus didn't even give up the information because he was afraid of the repercussions, because he knew the church. He was part of the church. And then Galileo had to recant it twice. And then they finally,
And Bruno and a whole variety of others, they were burned at the stake because they believed these things. So that's a high form of hubris.
Yeah, it was considered hearsay. But how are we doing it today? The power, the Orthodox Science's power structure. I mean, instead,
well, they make it difficult, if not impossible. They make it not pretty much impossible to publish these kinds of informations in most of the frontline journals. They still ridicule it because that's an aspect of fear, I suppose. They have found a way to keep it submerged for a long, long time, as I say, a century and a half, at least.
Mm-hmm.
So, because they're in the power position. But the general public, of course, they support all the scientific research being done in a country by their taxes. So in a democracy, eventually they'll realize that they can call the shots and say, this must be looked at, period.
That's what my book puts forth, exactly that information.
That becomes a very important thing.
How do they maintain their power? How did they even get this power in the first place?
Well, they have it. They started it with Newton, certainly, and Galileo and Kepler and others. And so they proved by the observations an understanding of nature, and then they therefore developed steam engines, power machines that brought forth technologies. People were able to make money. I mean, it was real. And so, indeed, I mean, it was very good. It created the Industrial Revolution.
Indeed. And are not
a big effect on the world, on humanity.
Our national character in America developed at the time of the Industrial Revolution. So we're known as the industrialized nation. I mean, that's how we developed our national character.
Exactly, and there was nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the physics that's been discovered. It's just that it's limited. And they have chosen, for whatever reason, there are a whole variety of reasons, but they're generally this hubris stuff. They've chosen to act this way because they're as hooked as the general public, that you only believe what you see, and you only believe things that function in distance time. You think that all there is distance time, and that really isn't true. It's going to be a very big surprise to them to realize that nature is so much richer than they imagine, and that there is great potential there. I mean, we have, with our work, we have applied consciousness to materials. We've, in fact, been able to embed specific intentions into a little electronic device, and we do it from a deep meditative state, and we can imprint intentions so as to change the properties of materials. Any physical material, but basically everything we've tried, we have been able to alter it, and we have shown that from our work that there is at least one other aspect of physical reality, which is in the coarse level of the physical vacuum, and so that a property of nature, of a material, it has two parts. One that comes from our normal electromagnetic world, and that is just background to us. And the second comes from this other aspect of space, which in my modeling, it's a reciprocal space. So that my model is that nature is not just distance-time, but it consists of two reciprocal subspaces, one of which is distance-time, and the other is its reciprocal, which is a frequency domain, because 1 over distance is number per unit distance, that's a frequency. 1 over time is number per unit time, that's also a temporal frequency in that case.
Really?
So that it's this new level of reality, there is the general property is the sum of something from our normal electric atom molecule world, but also from this intention affected reciprocal space world, so that now a property can be made larger in magnitude, can be made smaller in magnitude. So we have taken water, and you can measure the acid-alkaline balance of it, which is just called the measurement of pH. So we can change the pH up. We can make it more alkaline. We can change the pH down. We can make it more acidic. And we can change it by large factors so that huge changes can be made. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to help clarify for the listeners, what you're talking about right now is the power of intentions affecting physical matter.
Exactly. Yes, we have been doing that for a very long time. And so we also find that when we make these devices, these intention host devices, and use them to affect an experiment, we actually condition the space wherein the experiment is conducted. And we find that we change the reality of that space so that we can manifest many things. For example, if we take a liver enzyme like alkaline phosphatase and we can measure its chemical activity before entering a conditioned space, then we can just put it in that conditioned space for 30 minutes, take it out and measure it, and we can find that we've changed the chemical activity of this liver enzyme by as much as 30%. We've also, and with p-values better than 0.001, meaning that the possibility that this occurred by a random chance is only one chance in 1,000 or less.
Brilliant.
So
yeah.
We found we've looked at fruit fly larvae, or we've used the intention, again, we condition the space, and we have these larvae grow into adult flies, and usually it takes 28 days. Well, we have used the intention to increase the energy storage molecule, ATP, its 3 phosphorus atoms, versus its chemical precursor, which has only 2 phosphorus atoms. And that's the intention, and we find that we can increase that ratio by 10 to 15%, and that makes the larvae more physically fit.
Wow.
So that the larval development time to the adult fly stage can be reduced by 25% with p-values better than 0.001. So these are huge effects. So that, and certainly if you can affect things in fruit fly larvae, there's no reason why you can't influence similar processes in other living systems, like animals and ultimately humans.
So Bill,
remarkable things in medicine. We have found that we've learned how to broadcast some of these intentions over large distances.
Like
and
telepathy?
We found that we can significantly reduce human depression and anxiety by broadcasting an intention to them from one of our devices over an area of several thousand square miles from a distance of 1,000 miles away. So this is part of our future, really. I mean, what will turn out to ultimately be very important technology. For example, if we take the simple thing of the pH, one pH unit is very large. If you increase the pH, let's say, of a human blood by half a pH unit or reduce it by half a pH unit, you're probably dead on close end, on both ends. We know that even smaller amounts of pH change can, you can eliminate a coral reef. And as the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere goes up, then what that does, it makes the carbon dioxide dissolved into water more acidic, and therefore it is eating away at coral reefs around the world. So these are real phenomena, phenomena that are terribly important to us. Global warming, these are also possibilities that there may be a resolution of those things as we go to these higher levels of reality. We are undertaking an experiment now where we are going to be imprinting and broadcasting to children diagnosed as being autistic and to their parents.
Wow, wow.
And we are seeing a great growth in the population of autistic children in our world. I mean, now it's about 1 in 80.
Is it really not 1 in 80?
Yes. So that's been growing very rapidly. I think of these folks not as broken, but as forerunners of future Earth beings in the new epoch. Pardon me, I'm getting over a cold, so forgive my coughing.
It's okay. I'm
we
sorry.
We also have been doing experiments with the Buddha relics. Anyone who has gone to see the Maitreya Buddha relic tours that are going on around the world, they see something which has spreads loving kindness and huge healing capabilities for humans. And what these are, these relics, are pearl-like objects that are left in the ashes of cremation of the Buddha masters for the last sort of 2,500 years or so. And they appear to exhibit, from our experiments, they appear to exhibit consciousness, and that one can invoke that consciousness with intention and find that it can asking it to manifest itself in a way where we can measure its thermodynamic free energy, and we're able to do that in direct experiments. So indicating that these little objects, which are generally carried around in what's called a stupa, they are, during the relic tours, the custodians or the monks who are present, they are held over a person's head, and that increases the human vitality and in some cases brings about removal of serious illnesses, people on physical dialysis and so on. So the thing that is interesting, and interesting for us, is that it is possible with our techniques to invoke it to manifest in a way that where we see direct change in the energy, measured energy in the room with these relics. And ultimately, because they seem to be so uplifting to people, that will have a very large effect on future humanity, bringing forth an increase in loving kindness.
What do you mean by measured energy when these relics are in the room?
What we measure, we use three probes. One was a pH probe in the room, and the second was a temperature probe in the room. The third was a magnetic probe in the room. And we found we found that it was possible, if you put an unimprinted device of our type in the vicinity of the Buddha relics and just plug it into the wall socket and switch it on, so it's in the presence of the Buddha relics for maybe 33 days, then it becomes conditioned by this loving-kindness essence. And so we can use that as a vehicle to change the state of a room and measure it with those three probes. We find that if you increase the pH measurement of a room by one pH unit, that is equivalent to 23.6 millielectron volts. And we found in this particular experiment we did, if we didn't ask anything of it, we only got a very small increase in pH. But when we directly created an intervention, that is to intend and respectfully ask the Buddha relics to manifest themselves in such a way that we could thermodynamically measure the change in the room state with our probes, then almost immediately we saw the pH start to go up, and in a few weeks the pH had gone up by 2.5 pH units.
Wow.
That is a change of almost 60 millielectron volts. That's a very significant measurement change. And so now you could ask the question, here these things seem to be conscious, but they don't have anything you could call a brain, and they don't have anything you could call a neuron. And if you ask for them to manifest in this way, and they do, and yet these Buddha masters are basically, they're dead relative to our physical reality. They're in a higher dimensional reality. Mm-hmm. So this would seem to indicate that consciousness does not die at physical death. Now, it needs to be probed an awful lot more, but it's very interesting. Again, it's new stuff in nature, things of great importance to us, but it's not in the conventional distance-time box.
But it's
orthodox science.
But it's also, no, it's not, and that's what I come back. I came back after 10 years of living in Asia, and part of that time spent getting trained as a yoga teacher in India, and part of that time spent studying the use of consciousness in Qigong and Tai Chi and acupuncture in the traditional Chinese medicine model.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating because what you're talking about is in the yogic world, entrainment with the master, or in the Buddhist world, entrainment with the master.
And
energy healings. Like,
and they're not in this plane of reality.
But they're still existent nonetheless.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. They are, and people have had this question seemingly forever. Does consciousness survive death? The answer is unequivocally yes.
So, but what you're also talking about, though, is you're explaining telepathy. You're explaining how people have prayed away. There was a hurricane that was going to hit the west coast of Florida here where I am years ago, and people got together and did group prayers for it, and it had one of the most erratic storm patterns that the weather forecasters were saying. This is a really erratic storm pattern because it looked like it was getting ready to hit.
And the issue is, you see, that is part of our capability as students to both develop ourselves that way, which is what Qigong masters do. That's at the next level of reality, where unconscious also works and where homeopathy works. We've done experiments to show that the acupuncture meridian system is already at this higher gauge symmetry state that we create with this category of intention host device. So these are ways as we go forward. We need to learn about this. We need to learn how the connection occurs between the acupuncture meridian system and the chakras that humans have, which are higher dimensional functioning systems within the human being. So there's just a tremendous adventure available for people to get involved with as time goes on. And we will be able to create new businesses. It appears so far that we can enhance every technology that exists in the world today and create new ones. So there's lots of fun ahead if people will just open their minds and go forward and work on themselves as you did.
Thank you. Take yoga,
to learn to seriously meditate, to do qigong, etc. All of us, because we have the acupuncture meridians in us, if they're already at this higher level that we create with our devices and we imprint with our intention host devices, well, it says, therefore, if you intend for your system, your acupuncture meridian system, to flower and be more energetic and heal a part of your body, it can be done because it's already at this high gauge symmetry level, which is responsive in this particular way.
So when I'm working in an energy healing session, Bill, with somebody, and I get myself in the state, I kind of stay in at least an alpha brainwave state, and then in the sessions go into theta. And when I'm in this state, I know that I'm entraining my clients to me at this energetic level, but I'm also working directly over their chakras, and I'm working with the energy in the meridians, traveling it, opening up the chakras so that they flow out more energy to the meridians. All of this is intention, and all of this is imprinting my intention.
You don't need to use the device. The point is that human biofield can do these things if the individual is developed enough.
Apparently, because other people, and this isn't meant to be self-promotional, but other people have come to me after being with other energy healers, and they've said, how come I didn't feel like this with other energy healers? And I guess my response has become, well, there's some good doctors out there, and there's some not so good doctors out there. There's some people who are more...
We're all sort of children in the sense of, it's very much like muscle building. And if you go to a gym, you'll see some are really well-developed, some are mediumly developed, some are still poorly developed, etc. It doesn't put anyone down. We all have the capability to become adepts, and if we keep going on with this, we have the ability to become masters, and if we keep going on, we have ability to become avatars. These are human qualities. All of us have this possibility.
Don't you think this is where we're going, from the age of Newton physics?
Absolutely.
To the age of consciousness. I mean, that's what 2012's transference is, isn't it? The whole energy.
Well, it's been going on for it's been going on for maybe 50 years or 100 years, but it's a slow process to go from one epoch to the next epoch. The next epoch is a major one, very different than this one, where human consciousness, probably that which is our present unconscious has an information handling capacity just at the five physical senses level, which is about a million times that of our normal conscious mind, which is only less than 50 bits per second, maybe less than 12.
Wow.
So we're mostly asleep at the conscious level of reality, but our unconscious is doing all of this stuff. As we go to the next epoch, I think our conscious mind will be our future conscious mind will be our present unconscious. So that means...
Wow.
A million times more conscious in our daily life than people are today. And then the unconscious at that level of reality was probably up another million or billion. So that's what's coming in the next couple of centuries.
Conscious awakening, all the work that different energy healers do, like we do in Access Consciousness, with clearing the unconscious so that it becomes more actively conscious. It's just... awakening.
You give it meaning. The thing is that at the moment, the unconscious just, as I say, does all the work. It gathers all the data. It probably makes plots and solve equations and things, and then it creates little tiny kernels which have information at a level less than maybe 10 or 50 bits per second and feeds them to the conscious, so the conscious can have an experience of being alive, but only along those pathways that the conscious has given meaning to. If it doesn't give meaning to a thing, then all that preparation and all that stuff gets dumped. So if the general folks, the more they give meaning to, then the more the unconscious will build them. And that's how we become more and more and more. We all have the apparatus within us, so long as we keep working on it.
But if our focus lies elsewhere, then we're not going to be building this apparatus. We're going to just, like, dump out this ability and not pay attention to it or develop it.
No, exactly. I mean, that's where people are hooked today with the orthodox and all of the stuff that's on TV and all of the things that are in the politics and, you know, all that old crapola. It's unfortunate, but I guess I should say what I think is what is my prime working hypothesis.
Yeah.
My prime working hypothesis is that we are all spirits having a physical experience as we ride the river of life together. Our spiritual parents dressed us in these bio-body suits, put us in this playpen that we call a universe in order to grow in coherence, in order to develop our gifts of intentionality, and in order to become what we are intended to become, which is co-creators with our spiritual parents. That's our path, I think.
Wow, that's brilliant.
And lots of work ahead for us as we develop ourselves to truly be able to manifest things beyond our imagining.
So the coherent...
Beg your pardon?
I'm sorry? No, I'm sorry. What did you, that last part that you said?
Well, we're here in order to become coherent within ourselves instead of noisy within ourselves. Our world is very noisy, but coherent. Let me give you an example. If we take a simple 60-watt light bulb. It gives a bit of light, but not a lot of light. And the reason it's not a lot is because the photons that come out, or the waves that come out, have destructive interference with each other because they're incoherent. If you can organize the same number of photons coming out of that light bulb per unit time, then you will have an energy density maybe 100 times the surface of the sun from the same number of photons.
Wow.
And that, of course, in today's world, that's the laser. We're starting to use simple LED lasers in light bulbs and in for cars, in essence. This is the capability we have when I say to become more coherent with respect to each other.
So if I'm helping somebody, because this is great, I'm actually learning the science behind it, I feel like when I'm working with somebody, I'm helping to clear in their chakras blocks so that the unconscious wisdom in the chakras can become more actively on the surface and integrated with the person's conscious everyday experience. Does that make sense?
And that, as you help build another, you build yourself. So this is why loving kindness is so important.
Wow. So there's what you're saying is that there is so much more power in intention and coherence to have loving kindness and to...
Exactly.
It organizes in a stronger way, and there is more to be organized when
But the potential, this is the point about the light bulb example. The potential is there, but it's not manifest.
Yep.
It's not manifest until you make it coherent, in phase with each other, which can apply to politics. It can apply to all kinds of things. Certainly can apply to households. So if you do these things with respect to yourself, then you can get great benefits. I mean, you can do all kinds of self-healing, all kinds of sort of working on yourself to develop yourself, and so you don't really need orthodox medicine. because you do it for yourself.
But you,
you
say that.
For others.
That's the medicine of the future, is learning to manage the frequencies of the body, right?
Exactly. And it's all very much based on using your intention to do these things. But it's like muscle building and then internal muscles in this particular case. You're building infrastructure into yourself. And think of yourself as like a radio station. You want to increase the width of the transmission band of frequencies, and you want to increase the amplitude of all of those frequencies. So you become a power station instead of, let's say, 60 watts, you're 60 megawatts.
Oh, brilliantly put. Sir William Taylor, I thank you for your time. I'm getting signaled that we are completing the hour that we have been given together. So in much gratitude and in many blessings for your work, your pioneering spirit, your heart, and your wisdom. Thank you for your time.
It's been great to share with you and your audience.
Yeah, it's been great to have you here. Thank you.
Good. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Have a great weekend, y'all.
Thank you for joining us and allowing yourself this time to expand and become more of who you're here to be. Dr. K has a range of different offerings of her vibrational upgrades at all price points, including free. So for more information, please go to www.alisonjk.com. Dr. K's first book, What If There's Nothing Wrong, is available on Amazon.com. Dr. K also has a weekly clearing and activation call that is attended by her most advanced clients and students, an important activity in keeping themselves aligned and their vibration high. We'd love to have you come and play. Om Shanti.